Hey friends, let's take a moment and thank our sponsors because they make this podcast possible. Let's talk about a new sponsor, Revelo. Having a hard time hiring engineers? Revelo lets you sidestep the competitive U.S. talent market by helping you find and hire skilled remote engineers in Latin America. They only provide full-time senior engineers with over 5 years of experience, and they don't force you to pay for things you don't need, like a project manager. They charge a monthly fee, and you know exactly how much you're paying the engineers. They do the sourcing, they do the vetting, and you can interview the engineers before deciding. They'll manage all the paperwork, including benefits, payroll, and local compliance. And the time zone alignment is a huge win for U.S.-based teams, and it makes synchronous collaboration easy. Questions are answered quickly and effectively. To learn more, go to revelo.com/Hanselminutes. That's revelo.com/Hanselminutes. And as a special limited-time bonus, you can mention Hanselminutes, and you'll get 20% off the first 3 months. That's revelo.com/Hanselminutes. Hey friends, Scott Hanselman here. As an opener, just to explain this episode, every once in a while a famous person has a book, and then they come around to do a book tour, and they'll come to Microsoft and Google and all of the bookstores. And Randall Monroe wrote a book, and he came to Microsoft as part of our internal outside-in speaker series. I got to interview him, and then we spoke with the team and Randall's team, and he agreed to let us put the same audio from the book tour on this podcast. So this is a special episode of Hanselminutes brought to you by Randall Monroe and the Outside In team at Microsoft. Enjoy. Hey friends, I'm Scott Hanselman and it's Outside In. I'm here chatting with Randall Monroe. He's the author of What If 2 and the very popular and long-running webcomic XKCD. How's it going, sir?
It's great. How are you?
You know, I've got to say I'm a little nervous. It's because I went to community college. And I'm not very good at math, but I've spent the last 30 years trying to get good at math. What is your academic background?
I did an undergraduate degree in physics, and I did a minor in math and computer science, but I feel like I never know whether to mention minors or not. Like, they're sort of like middle names. It's like, I'm pretty sure it's officially recorded somewhere, but I'm not sure it really counts, you know?
But if you add, I have a minor in Spanish, like,
yeah, okay. Then you're like, you're just saying like, hey, I did a bunch of Spanish stuff, you know, okay, cool. You probably know some Spanish. Yeah, but no, I think I did a degree in like everything that was in the one building that had computer science, math, physics. It was a small university, so there was just a lot of overlap. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of areas where I've learned more from doing What If and from just like trying to solve problems on my own from debugging spreadsheets. Like, there are whole areas of math that I just touched on briefly in school and have done way more of now. And then areas, you know, that I did in school and now can barely remember. Like, honestly, most of integration in calculus, I don't ever want to say, you know, don't worry about it, it's not important. I don't use it a lot.
Yeah.
Compared to a lot of statistics, probability, man, linear algebra. Mm-hmm. Those are things where... those do come up if you're doing a lot of math in everyday life. But integration computers can do now. I'm sort of like, all right, come on, computers, take this one away from me. I don't want to remember how to do integration by parts.
Do people assume that you have a PhD, though? Do you have like people just like, oh, doc, they ever call you doctor accidentally? Because they like assume because your book has equations, you must be a doctor.
They do. I think I would not really worry about it either way. I'm very like non-picky about that kind of thing. The only reason I do try to correct people on that one is it is pretty striking how often people will assume that I have a doctorate and add doctor, but then I know a lot of women who do have doctorates who get the reverse. And on their behalf, I am picky about it because I don't like that people make the mistake in that direction with me when they make it in the other direction with women so often.
That's a very cool thing to do. I would even go so far as to say that you are very careful in all things to have disclaimers. I am not an official scientist. I am just a person who's an internet cartoonist. You did another book called Thing Explainer that was so well thought of that they actually took some of the visualizations and they put them into high school textbooks. And you were also very careful to make sure that you are saying you're not a science educator. Why so many disclaimers?
I mean, in a way, it's just another way of expressing and making explicit uncertainty, which is like a big sort of pet peeve of mine in science in general, is like this idea that you get a number and that number is exactly correct. And it doesn't have, in real life, all numbers have uncertainties attached. They all have like both uncertainty and the actual value, in the sense of like, we measured it, but the equipment only has this much uncertainty. And then there's like epistemic uncertainty, I think is what it's called. That's like uncertainty that you are using the device correctly, you know? And both of those together, like you have to account for that or your answers are going to be wrong. And in the same way, I try to account for, you know, I've looked up this thing. I have determined this is the mass of Jupiter. This is the gravitational constant of the universe. You know, I checked it on these two places and they both agreed. That means I'm pretty confident it's correct. Like, I would probably check a third. If I was going to trust my life to a calculation, I would probably like check a third one. But, you know, in any case, I want to keep in mind, how sure am I about this? Because I don't want to be the person that someone points to and it's like, well, he said it and he's the authority here and everything is completely right. And I'm like, I want to make clear what my uncertainty is, you know, what my errors are. And then other people can be like, well, he seems pretty certain and I don't trust him, so I'm going to add some more uncertainty there. And I think that's all healthy. That's good. People should go to the best sources of information you have. And it's not like question everything. It's just understand uncertainties attached to everything.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of ironic, because like half of these questions are like, my roommate and I want to know about the, you know, the weight of an unladen sparrow or whatever. And they're going to you, the authority, the internet cartoonist, for the tiebreaker.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, often there'll be like, either they'll explicitly mention this or it'll just be like subtext. They'll be like, we've been arguing about this, but we didn't think it was a question that was worth bothering a real scientist about. but then we both agreed you seemed like a good person to answer it. And I'm like, well, that's sort of a burn, but also like, you're not wrong. I am interested and do have the, you know, nothing better to do. Or if I do have something better to do, when they'll ask me the question, I feel like hearing a really interesting question like that is like kind of like getting a song stuck in your head where you just can't quite drop it. You can't focus on anything else until you've, all right, wait, I'm going to go figure out what's the answer. Then I'll devote a lot of time to settling this argument between these two people to my satisfaction, and hopefully then to theirs.
A lot of time. And it shows. So the subtitle here is Additional Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions. So people on the internet ask you questions that are arguably absurd. Mm-hmm. They say, what if I want to lose 20 pounds? How much of the Earth's mass would I have to relocate into space in order to achieve my goal? They're assuming that their weight is relative to the mass of the Earth. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you just remove mass of the Earth. And you spend an exquisite 20 pages on this trying to figure this out. And then, of course, bait and switch at the end and fool us. And it's fantastic. How much work happens in that? Is that a month's work when you think about those problems?
So I have to do an amount of work that will get me to an answer that I'm satisfied with. But what's fun about these questions is that if you get to the answer really easily or really quickly, then usually it raises some new questions along the way. And so I'll be like, okay, wait, I want to explore why that's true. And so I will just keep going down those rabbit holes. And so often the sort of core research, you know, the core calculations, there'll be a day where I'm like, I want to get to this answer and I'm going to get to the answer as quickly as I can. And then keep going down these rabbit holes, until I have sort of feel like, okay, I've answered all the questions that I've come across in the process of this, or I fell asleep at my desk, you know. And then once I've been like, okay, I need to stop, I need to pull back from here. What's the cool stuff I've learned? Let me assemble that together into a chapter. And then that can itself take time and often raises new questions. Then I have to go back and research again. But I usually feel like there's one big research sprint where I answer the central question, like in the course of a day. But now and then answering the question just takes the first few minutes almost. And then it's rabbit holes from there on out. One of my favorite examples of that was, there was a question where someone asked, what if I funnel all of Niagara Falls through a soda straw? And this is a question that is almost surprisingly easy to answer. Because if you take the flow rate of Niagara Falls, that's going to be measured in gallons per minute or some unit like that. It's volume per time. And if you take the a drinking straw and measure its area, that's, you know, you can get its area in square centimeters by taking its diameter and, you know, multiplying by pi and squaring it and stuff. And then if you want to know how fast the water is going to have to flow to go through the drinking straw, you just divide those two numbers. And as long as you carry the units through it, it gives you an answer in speed. And so if you take the flow rate of Niagara Falls, say, go Google it to get a preliminary number. And then I looked up a McDonald's drinking straw, found their specs where they publish those, and then divide it, and you get an answer, which is about a third the speed of light. So that tells you that if you try to funnel Niagara Falls through a drinking straw, in order to get all that water through that quickly, it would have to be moving as fast as the speed of light. Right away, like, you know, that's not going to work. If you did somehow have a way to accelerate the water up to that speed, it would come out the other end and be a water jet cutter that, like, cut through the crust of the earth. You know, it would be very dramatic, and dramatic in a way that what if articles are often, you know, my answers often turn out to be dramatic because they involve someone taking some variable and pushing it way out to the edge. But there was the step back there where I was like, you Google flow rate of Niagara Falls. And if you do this, you'll see the flow rate of water over Niagara Falls is set by a treaty between the US and Canada, because the US and Canada share Niagara Falls. Mm-hmm. And both countries like can withdraw water from the Niagara River for hydroelectric power. There's a big drop there. You can get power. There's irrigation. But both countries also have an incentive to maintain the falls as a natural wonder. It's part of our, you know, heritage. It's this beautiful treasure. And no one wants it to go away. So we agreed both countries would limit their withdrawals to keep the flow rate above, it's like 100,000 units. It's like gallons per minute or something over or cubic meters per second. I forget the unit.
Okay.
You know, it's 100,000 units during the day and then 50,000 at night. They reduce the flow
rate.
Just
a dimmer.
Dimmer switch. Not as many tourists. You don't need to be quite as good for the photos. So if you're going to withdraw a bunch of water, you do it at night. And so I just, you know, I wanted to check, okay, what's the best value I can get here? I don't want to just go off of some Google result. And so I pull up the treaty and see it mentions that, because I'm like, also, how do you enforce that? And it mentions in the treaty, each country, the US and Canada, will each appoint an officer to certify compliance with the treaty. It'll be a team of two. And to me, that seemed like right away, that raises a bunch of new questions for me. Like,
are they on opposite sides? Are
yeah.
They looking at each
well,
other?
Like, so like, what kind of people do you pick? What powers, how do they tell if you're in compliance? You know, presumably they go to like whoever the water management authorities are and they're like, can we see your books? Can we see the flow rate graphs? How do you know you're not being shown fake graphs? You know, do they go and check out the pumps? Like, what level of inspection do they do? What if they find there's water missing? Are they empowered to return it? Like to go and track down what happened to it? Can they punish? Do they have a power of arrest? Is it like a 007 thing?
Yeah.
Can they kill? Like
if they have enough power, like if they have enough experience, can they like eyeball it? And they go like, it feels like.
Yeah, exactly. Like in my head, these people immediately became like Mulder and Scully, you know? So I know that probably the actual answer is they just get to write a report. But I'm like, I'm going to mention who they are right now. I want to put their names and titles in here. And I'm like, okay, this is probably, they're appointed by two countries in an international procedure. This is probably like documented somewhere that's easy enough to find, right?
And I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to stalk the Niagara Falls people all the way down to their LinkedIn page.
Listen, they are public, they are public servants. They are doing, you know, they are working for all of us to protect this resource that we all love. Like they should, they're publishing this stuff, it's for the good of all of us, you know. And I really am just a sucker for like that kind of civic kind of activity. It's like, you know, like the national parks, like everyone likes that we have national parks.
Well, it's a thankless job. There are unnamed people out there and you want to name them, bring them
and
to the spotlight.
I'm like, I want to find out who these people are and then talk about how I imagine them as Mulder and Scully, you know? And so I go to look it up and I start quickly learning that like, there's a lot of commerce around the Great Lakes. there are a lot of different regulatory agencies that handle different aspects of it, pollution and shipping and like who's dealing with the zebra mussels and that kind of thing. And they all have committees that like overlap with each other because people who work on one of them tend to work on other stuff. And then there are like super committees for different things that cover all the Great Lakes. And they all have websites that are of wildly varying degrees of like up to date. And so I start like going through and trying to figure out, okay, which one is responsible for like documenting the appointment of these officials under the treaty? Because the treaty doesn't say. So fast forward 6 hours, I have every one of their websites opened. Every time I like try to Google like, okay, but this group must have a website of their own that where they have these PDFs. Where are those stored? And I Google and all the links are purple. Mm. And I'm like, oh no. I'm going in circles. This is my own footprints.
Can't you get them on the horn? I mean, are you like on speakerphone with them? Like on the red phone?
I never feel more like a stereotypical millennial than when I'm researching an answer to a what if question, because it's amazing the lengths I will go to avoid making a phone call, even if that would really make things easier. But in this case, like what I ended up doing was for another question, I needed to talk to the Harvard Law Library because someone wanted to know how long will it take to read all of the laws that cover that they are, you know, have to obey because you don't want to break any laws. And I was like, okay, so how many laws are there? And this is sort of a weird and subtle question. And so I get in touch with the Harvard Law Library and talk to their librarians. And they were really helpful about this. And then on the side, they were mentioning how their repositories of treaties that are like kept in a chamber, you know, at the State Department, where all of the treaties that we have signed, there are like two copies of them. And I was like, hey, speaking of treaties... Do you know when they appoint officers under this one treaty? Where is that documented? Does Harvard have a copy of that? And they were like, I'm not sure, but hang on a minute. And then a little bit later, I get an email from the Harvard Law Library. And it's like, all right, well, we just reached out to the Joint Commission for Waterways Management. And here they've replied very politely, you know, very nicely with like, yeah, our current officers are appointed by this process. The current officers are so-and-so and so-and-so, you know, and they're very nice. And like, here's some biographic information. And the librarians sent that on to me. And then a little bit later, they're like, oh, and here another committee sent us more information. Here you go. Here's everything you could possibly want. And the lesson for me is like, librarians are the best. Like they are very good at just going out and finding what you need.
Oh, we totally learned about that. Like during the pandemic, having librarians, they wouldn't let us into the library, but they bring the book out to us. We spent all of our time out front of the library having them bring answers to questions.
Oh, librarians are great. Just if you've got, there's a lot of information out there in the world and they are the ones who are in charge of figuring out where it all is.
I saw a guy on TikTok recently who no disrespect to him, but he said he was a self-identified non-reader, but he said everyone, like all you on TikTok that are watching this TikTok should go to the library and get a library card, even if you're not going to use it, because it'll make their usage numbers goes up and then they'll get more money because we love our librarians.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is like a Nicolas Cage level national adventure here where Nick Cage goes in and then they find these treaties like rolled up in parchment. Mm-hmm. This is like a whole thing.
Yeah. It's always weird when there's a physical object, you know, like that where you're like, that's like a very abstract thing, but there is actually one it's like up until very recently, there was the reference kilogram.
Yeah.
That was like a kilogram is defined as however much this thing weighs.
In Switzerland in a box somewhere?
Yeah, yeah. And they finally, like 2 years ago or a year ago, redefined it to be just the weight of this many, you know, cesium atoms. It's some atom, of an atom of some metal. And that was defined with, you know, the mass of the proton, the mass of something. They came with a rigorous definition that no longer depends on this artifact. But it was weird that there was a kilogram out there. It was the only, like, that was the official one.
My wife and the kids and I were in Geneva a couple of weeks ago, and I was like trying to convince two teenage boys why we need to go find the reference kilogram at CERN and why that would be fun. It was not a thing they wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's a tough sell because it doesn't do anything really exciting. In fact, that's exactly what they're trying to get it to.
A kilogram.
It was like occasionally very slowly losing mass, and that was a big problem. They had to like figure out how to stop that. You know, you don't want the kilogram. You don't want the reference kilogram doing anything.
Sometimes in the book, you will say something that it feels like maybe you thought was a throwaway, but I thought should be an entire extra chapter, and it never happens. This one about the Earth losing mass so that I can lose mass. I want to lose 20 pounds. You just have this throwaway sentence here. Oh, you launched several hundred billion tons of rocks into orbit, thereby shaving off 2 millimeters of rock from the Earth's surface. And then you just kind of continue on. I'm like, where did that number come from? Do you have those numbers? You just didn't put them in the book. Are they in some OneNote somewhere?
Yeah. I spend a lot of time on Mathematica is really good for this kind of calculation. I'm probably one of the heaviest users of their unit-aware computing. And this, I think, comes out of like doing a physics degree, especially doing a physics degree when I did one, when it was just before there were really good unit-aware calculators out there, you know, where you could say 1 gallon divided by 1 mile and get an answer that's, you know, in square feet. Like, now that computers can do that, to me, it's like a miracle. And Mathematica has some great tools for this. For you know, you can type like 1 gallon divided by 1 meter and get the answer in the correct units, and like it just like carries it through for you. And that's like the dream that I've had for so many years. And so now it works, and I love that.
That's awesome. So each one of these is like a Mathematica notebook.
Yeah, so I've got those. I mean, there's a lot more though than just like doing the math. It's like, which numbers do you use? And some of those decisions are things where like I could lay it all out in there, but it's almost like bookkeeping. Like when I say we shave about this much rock off of the Earth's surface, like there are a bunch of different ways you could do this. Like you could say, well, like, wait a minute, you know, most of the Earth is like sand or soil and not bedrock. So are we talking about taking the top 2, you know, millimeters of whatever's there, which might be more or less dense? Mm-hmm. Or are we talking about taking an equivalent amount to 2 millimeters of rock? The kind of bedrock you get on land and the kind of bedrock you get in the ocean have different densities, you know? And my answer to that is it doesn't matter. It's you can figure that out and you could define which one you're using. But it wouldn't change the answer very much.
You know that because of the Mathematica? Like, because you're yada, yada, yada-ing over several hundred billion tons.
What you could do is, if you wanted to say, well, let's just take the top 2 centimeters of everything and figure out how much that weighs, like how many centimeters you have to take if you're just taking everything. You've then got to answer the question, are we following the bottom of the ocean? Or are we going across the surface of the water? And are your 2 centimeters for 70% of the Earth going to be water? Which is like, you know, about a little over a third as dense as like crust rock in the continents. So you can make one of those two choices and it'll change whether it's 2.5 centimeters or, you know, 3.2 centimeters.
Okay.
And I don't care which one, you know, I'm trying to give a sense of whether we're talking about a continent, you know, like whether we're talking about all of the crust or a thin layer or what, you know?
Yeah.
Like I alluded to a couple of things in my explanation just there. When you say top centimeters, top few centimeters, and you have a grassy field, do you start at the top of the grass or at the bottom? Do you start at the dirt level? But like the dirt gets more compacted as you go down. And if you ever like looked really close at dirt, it's like kind of fractal, you know, where do you draw the line? And the answer is like you pick somewhere to draw it and then you document it. Or the answer is you decide, well, here is an answer that is correct for a number of reasonable values of where you could draw that line to the precision that we are talking about these numbers. And thus there's no point in getting it more precise and laying out this entire process in the book.
And if ever there was an example of like, and that's science, like every single thing in here, you're like, well, it depends. So we'll pick a number that seems reasonable and then we'll continue on our way.
Well, and once this comes back to the question of uncertainty, like there are places where it really matters, you know, how much, like, are we talking about the density of rock or of sand, you know, and then wet sand or dry sand, where like, if you're going to be comparing these, if you're going to be subtracting one number from another number, if you're going to be subtracting two masses, then very small differences in density can make gigantic differences to the end number. And then you have to be extremely sure you are using the right one. When you're doing a comparison, try to give a sense of how much of the Earth are you peeling away here. The way that you do that affects the answer. Because in the end, what I said there was a few centimeters.
Yep.
I didn't say 2.3 centimeters. And part of that is because I'm not going to lay out a rigorous definition of what I mean. But I'm going to say for most reasonable definitions or for a reasonable one that I used here, like, I specifically mentioned rock there. And that way, if you think about it, you can be like, well, does that mean, what about the grass? That's really low density. But like, well, it did say rock. So I guess we must be cutting through the grass, you know? So maybe we're taking a sliver of bedrock. Like, and yeah, that'll get you about right. But it's also, this is for the purposes of understanding the amount of mass we're talking about, not for the purposes of understanding how grass works. Because how grass works is a really cool question, but it's like a different one.
Hey friends, this is Scott. I hope you're enjoying this chat, but we are going to take a brief break and we're going to have a chat with our sponsor. Our sponsor, Raygun, today makes shows like this possible. You know, JD from Raygun, I am realizing that I am afraid of my website. I am afraid of it at runtime because I just don't know what it's doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to like our own health, right? Do I go to the doctor and find out something's wrong, or do I just kind of pretend that maybe I'm okay? And, you know, frankly, the healthiest people, they're getting checked up.
That's exactly right. And when I plugged in Raygun error, crash, and performance monitoring, what I'm seeing immediately are bugs. I was flooded with them. And I was like, oh no, this is horrible. But then I started realizing as Raygun starts to categorize them and bucket them and realize that, well, these are normal runtime bugs. These are script kiddies. These are people poking around asking for files that don't exist. But then I could start to see where, how, and why the users that I care about are getting errors. And I went from being afraid to go to the doctor to wanting to turn Raygun on all of my projects, like by default.
Absolutely. One thing with Raygun is it's about connecting the code. We say code to customer, but really it's about the user. You know, it is always about the user. It's not really about the software at all. And so how do we make sure we're understanding which of our users are having a great time and which ones could we improve it for?
That is a great point, because those users, they don't want to send me log files. They don't want to go and collect the bugs and the repros and stuff like that. So Raygun gives me the line of code and information about the user that's private, that says, this user in this country is having a problem, or this user at this time on this platform is having an issue, and I can go straight to the solution. And it's like a support assistant and a dedicated reliability engineer that presents me a clear bug report. It's fantastic. So folks can go to raygun.com. They can sign up for a trial, and you can have this same experience that I'm having, this epiphany of Schrodinger's bug. You can go and find out the bugs at runtime that you're missing, and you can take control of your experience and your user's experience. Check it out at raygun.com.
Thinking about the context that here I am, a nerd computer programmer with your book, Dog-Eared, and with these little tags with all the questions that I have. And I'm a pretty straightforward, regular person. I can only assume that there are other copies of the book out there that are even more dog-eared. Are they sending you like, gotcha? Like, is your email just filled with like, I want to check, like Knuth sends checks out for like $2 mm-hmm. if you find a mistake?
Yeah, I am definitely, you know, I'll make algebra mistakes as much as the next person. We have very good fact checkers that manage to catch most of that stuff and people who just redo the math. But certainly, you know, mistakes slip through. Future printings will sometimes have numbers corrected or things corrected that, you know, I learned, oh no, a court determined that in fact, the waterfall police do not have jurisdiction over this. And then I have to, you know, update that. What's really interesting though, is, whenever I'm writing about any of these science topics, I know that like the people who work on these things might read it, you know, like the people for anything I'm writing about here, there are people out there who know way more about it than me. And like, I try to, you know, keep in mind, it like keeps me humble, you know, knowing that like they're going to look at this. So like, I'm going to try to make it as best as I could, like, make it correct as best as I can and not go beyond what I feel like, you know, I can prove to myself and I can prove. And what I find is, you know, sometimes people will be like, you know, actually, when you say the top few centimeters, are you considering water or are you considering land? And I'm like, okay. But what's really interesting is hearing from people who know about the stuff and want to like show me, point out an effect I didn't know about or tell me about, or test, you know, say we have data on this thing that you were speculating about. We can offer a correction or a modification or whatever. And that just like, I feel like that's almost like I'm excited because now I'm learning more than I knew before, you know?
Yeah.
In my last book, I had a chapter on, someone asked, how high would you have to drop a steak from for it to be perfectly cooked when it hits the ground? Because when stuff enters the atmosphere, it's going to like get heated Meteors get hot because they're going so fast when they hit the atmosphere that the air compresses in front of them. And the when you compress air, it heats up, and it heats up enough to glow, and it heats up enough to cook things. And so in theory, there should be a height that you could drop a steak from where it'll get heated up somewhat, but not all the way through, you know, not burned. And this was a fun question to research. So I know from like aerospace stuff, the calculation for what will the pressure be on the leading edge of something moving at supersonic speeds. And in fact, there's math you can do for this, but for a long time, NASA had a calculator, a web calculator. And I would just go to that because I knew it worked. But it was like built in Flash way back when. And every time I go back to it, it's like I have to do a new step to get the browser to work. And then at some point I was like, okay, I should just re-implement the equations because Flash has been dead for a long time now. So I had all the calculations to say, how hot will the air at the surface of the steak get? And then I was like, okay, I need to figure out, I'm applying this much heat to the surface, and I know that that will cook, you know, that it'll very quickly sear the things. How quickly will the heat propagate through the steak as it's coming in? Because the heat's going to go up and then down. And so I start getting like thermal flow, thermal conductivity of meat, trying to figure out, you're applying heat to the surface here, how quickly will it get carried through the meat, and what temperature will the different parts of it rise to? And this is a much tougher physics calculation because it involves like just bulk flow of heat through materials in three dimensions is complicated, you know, and I'm trying to approximate as best I can, but it's a calculation I haven't done, you know, a lot. And so I'm like looking up engineering textbooks. And then after like 20 minutes of like, I think that I've got the equations right here, it occurred to me there is a better way to figure out how the application of heat to one side of a steak is going to result in heat propagating through the other side of the steak, which is to get a cookbook. Because this is like, there is a subject matter expertise on this that's very practical. And that was much easier. You're just like, oh, you put a steak on a griddle at this temperature for this much time, it's going to be, you know, cooked this well through. And I felt kind of sheepish, but that got me the answer. So I was happy.
Once you figured out that's where the information was and not the NASA website.
Yeah. But the one thing I was not sure about, and I did not find an easy answer for, is like when a steak is falling at hypersonic speeds and it's like a raw steak, things tumble in weird ways in the atmosphere. And this is a huge area of study for debris scattering when things re-enter. You've got big satellites that re-enter in the atmosphere and they break up. And like the really lightweight stuff slows down really quickly and falls like early. They have a debris footprint, and like the heaviest, densest, strongest things will go the farthest, and things will spread out. And there's a lot of work into modeling how things will fall and how they'll flutter in the air and how quickly they'll slow down. This is relevant for a bunch of different areas, and it's incredibly hard. Like it's turbulent fluid dynamics of irregularly shaped objects. And like, you can do theoretical calculations on this. You can spend, you know, days and you'll have one object and you'll know how it will work in one set of like
one
temperature conditions. So really you've just got to like throw computing power at it is the right way to do that these days. But that's also really hard. So that's a place where I said, I don't know what a steak will do when it's falling through the air, whether it will like oscillate and break itself apart, or, you know, will it fall face first, sort of like a capsule, you know, or will it tumble? And if it tumbles, maybe it'll be cooked evenly on all sides. But if it tumbles too fast, it might pull itself apart. And so I just, that was a place where I'm like, okay, this is too hard. I don't know how to answer this. And I just had a footnote saying like, this will depend on how your steak tumbles. I couldn't find any data on how on the aerodynamic properties of raw steak at hypersonic speeds. But if you have a hypersonic wind tunnel and some steak and want to do some experiments, let me know, you know. And I got a letter a couple of years later from two doctoral students at the University of Manchester who said they had just finished their hypersonic heating experiments for their doctorate, and they had some time left over in the tunnel. And so they got a steak and hooked it up on the armature, the thing that holds it. And they sent me videos. And it was really cool. They had thermal videos showing how the steak heated up. And I was really excited. I was happy that I was generally right about how the surface of the steak would heat up, and how it would singe, sear away, and then bits of it would be blown away by the wind, and then that would expose more raw steak, and it would heat up. You know, it'd be seared and ablated away. And so the answer to the question is you'd end up with a steak that is still mostly raw when it landed. And the wind tunnels bore that out. The interior of the steak did not get hot. The outside got seared and then burned away. I definitely underestimated how unappetizing a steak would be after it was subjected to these conditions. It looked more ragged than what I drew.
So you honestly thought this would be edible at some point?
I mean, I don't. It's going to be raw steak either way.
Yeah.
But aesthetically speaking, it sort of looked like you know, the edge of a really worn carpet. Like the fibers are just kind of like, it's like you've just taken it and like rubbed it against something. It's like you took a steak and rubbed it against like sandpaper, like roughly, and then seared it with a blowtorch. It didn't look like neatly seared, like if you set it on a burner. It was seared in a way that looked like it fell from space. And when I was illustrating it and I drew the steak, I did it with like a nice curve and the front face of it is like getting blackened. And really it's more like it's getting thrown in the dryer, you know.
So whether it be going to the NASA website and trying to run old flash applets or checking a cookbook, sometimes you can actually call experts. And they're on the cover of What If 2, there is a T-Rex on what looks like a 747 or some kind of a commercial jetliner here. But I didn't find any reference to that or chapter about that. Did you call for help to figure out what was going on with
T-Rex? Yeah. Sort of. So I drew this, like with What If 1, I have an illustration on the cover that tries to show the general vibe of the book. And in both cases, it's not something that I specifically answer in the book. It's sort of a logo, you know, cool drawing. But for my book How To, I did get to interview Chris Hadfield, who is an astronaut, former commander of the International Space Station, and also a test pilot who's flown like over 100 different aircraft. And I got to interview him on, you know, how to land a plane. I decided I was going to try to throw weird questions at him. My plan was to start with simple landing scenarios and then make them more and more ridiculous until he hung up on me and I would see how far I could get. It turned out, to my surprise and delight, that, so as you might expect, test pilots are not easy to fluster by throwing weird situations at them. So everything I asked him, he just matter-of-factly, no hesitation, answered. And like, I would get weirder and weirder and he would just like, oh yeah, here's what I'd do if I were trapped on the outside of a plane trying to control it. You know,
I love that you're willing to burn a personal bridge with an internationally famous astronaut for us, for science.
It ended up creating a bridge. So like he answered all my questions. I went to the end of my document. He's like, you got anything else? And I was like, no, I'm going to have to come up with some more and email you. So he's great. He was great. So as a consequence of talking to him about this, I had his phone number. So I'm drawing this airplane with a T-Rex on the roof. And I had actually calculated like how are these airplanes built? Could they support the weight of a T-Rex? And I think for the most part they could. There would definitely be a danger of it stepping through the thinner parts of the aluminum, but like the ribs, I think could support that weight. They have to be strong enough to support the weight of the overhead bag compartments. And in a drop test, those will be subjected to incredible amounts of force, effectively like multiplying their weight by a factor of a lot. And so the T-Rex weight on top is comparable. So like the ribs of the plane, it can support a T-Rex. So I'm drawing this and being like, yeah, you could have a T-Rex climbing on top of your plane. I take a photo of my drawing and text it to Colonel Hadfield and ask him, so how do you think this plane would handle? And I just, what I love about astronauts and test pilots is how like nonchalant they are about everything. So he just texts back like, just fine. As long as the T-Rex doesn't wander too far away from the center of gravity, because, you know, too far forward or backward and you'll get out of the range of what the control surfaces can support.
So you placed him at the center that is appropriately.
Yeah.
Centered.
I mean, he was saying like it, if it's gotten to the air, it's at the center of gravity. You know, it depends on where the people in the cabin are. But he replies, he replies with that answer. And then a photo of the shuttle, carrier aircraft, which is the Boeing 747 that carried the space shuttle. It's kind of similar configuration. And he's like, it handles fine, handles like a normal plane. You know, a little different, but it, you can do that. So his answer was like, oh, fine. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, so what would you do if you're in this situation is trying to chew through the roof? And again, and I love no hesitation. I just get the typing indicator right away. And, he says, nose down, try to get negative G's so that it'll, meaning so the T-Rex will be pulled up off of the plane because you've nose down. Also, all your passengers, if they don't have their seatbelts on, are going to get flung into the ceiling. So that's why he probably hits the seatbelt sign before he starts the maneuver. And then he's like, you know, or you dive to gain speed, the wind will pull it off, or, you could try rolling back and forth. And I was like, okay, well, wait. Now suppose this is a T-Rex that everyone thought was extinct and it's now shown up on your plane. This might be the only one alive. We don't know where it came from. This could be invaluable to paleontology, to science, to, you know, this extinct animal is here.
Bring it back.
And you're
alive.
Just going to throw it off the roof.
Yeah.
Like what about, you know, what if you're trying to preserve this animal for the sake of paleontology? And he just replied, not my concern, which I think is like the attitude you want in your pilot.
Yeah.
He's like, and so I know that pilots have this mantra of like, your priorities, aviate, navigate, communicate. That's what you do. First, get control of the aircraft in any situation. Second, figure out where you are and where you're going. Third, communicate with the ground and with other pilots and with passengers about what's happening. And those are your priorities in that order. And so he says, not my concern. And so I text back like, yeah, I guess like do paleontology doesn't really fit in with aviate, navigate, communicate. It's probably below those. And he just replied, honestly, communicate is a distant third.
Really?
Yeah. So test pilots, they've got their priorities straight. they are going to keep the plane, keep the plane intact, keep the passengers safe, get it onto the ground in one piece. They know their mission. And that getting on a plane, always thinking about that conversation, honestly comforts me. It's like,
that's awesome. You know, I've been writing and blogging for many years, and sometimes people will ask me a question. And long ago, I stopped emailing them back directly because they sent me a question, but I only have so many keystrokes left in my hands before I die. So it's a waste of my keystrokes to email them back. But the question is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, what a great question. Oh, my God. So I got to put those keystrokes somewhere. I've been nerd sniped.
Mm-hmm.
So I put it on the blog and I send it back. Do you feel the same way? Like the question that comes in is a gift and you just go, oh, this is perfect. And then you've been nerd sniped and you're ruined for the day.
Yeah, definitely. I would occasionally, I will. So that's how I started doing this originally, was people would write to me to answer these questions. And then I would get sucked into doing all this research to answer it. And then once I've done 6 hours of research, I'm like, well, now I've got to write a response, you know, just cause I want to share what I found. And then at some point I was like, I should just, instead of emailing these to one person, I should, you know, save these and I can make a book or something. Cause this is fun. And also because I am going to get sucked into answering the question anyway. So it might as well, those hours of work may as well go towards something, useful. Someone else might find it interesting. Anytime I get too, I think too much about like, I only have so many keystrokes, you know, in my hands, it's true. But then also I look at like what I do spend them on. And it's like now and then I'll look at like how much I text about like arguing with someone about something that is not important to anything, but I'm trying to make a point, you know, and I'm like, this is not useful. This is like a theory about Star Wars.
Well, someone is wrong on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. And then like, I'm like, oh yeah, I didn't have time to reply to this other email or something. And it's like, I definitely did have time. I don't have, you know, I'm making excuses, but you know, some of the questions that I've gotten from my book, one of my favorite questions in here was something that a friend just texted to me, like apropos of nothing, someone I hadn't talked to in a couple of years. And they texted, what would a star smell like if it were possible, if such a thing were possible, like if smelling a star were possible? And this is a cool question because like the easy answer is, you know, well, that's not possible. if you could smell it, then it wouldn't be a star. You know, a star is extremely hot and it would burn your nose, you know, and like you would be incinerated. But like, that's sort of the boring answer. But there is a more interesting answer. Like, if you did take solar plasma and somehow cooled it down to the point where it was not burning your nasal passages, you can, and like just put bits of it into your nose, you can figure out what would happen, what it would smell like. There are experimental studies of cancer patients where people who have gotten radiation to their for cancers that are near the nasal passages where the olfactory nerve, the olfactory bulb was in the path of the radiation. They do report strong smells, and they seem to be strong smells created by the radiation most likely ionizing the atoms in the mucus surrounding the olfactory bulb, you know, basically dissociating the water molecules in there and creating free hydrogen ions and free radicals.
Isn't that just burning flesh, though?
No, because it is hydrogen and oxygen ions, and that bind to the olfactory nerve. Mm. And this is probably similar to the kinds of plasma that you get in the atmosphere of a star. And we can look at what smell they report. And it is, I list a whole bunch of the adjectives they use, but basically they say it's like bleach, burning hair, burning rubber, like a really acrid smell, and like ozone, which makes sense.
I was just going to say.
And if you want to smell the smell yourself, it's also the smell you'll get. If you smell pure ozone, you're doing a similar chemical process and smelling basically the same thing. So if you have an electrical spark, and you smell that, you know, or
after lightning storm.
Yeah, or if you've you can get these cool USB lighters that do a little arc of electricity.
Yeah,
that they're really neat. And I had one of those, and I was like, hey, I don't smoke. I just thought it was a cool gadget. I've never had a use for it because I didn't need to start a fire when I had it. But I was like, hey, I can smell this and smell what a star would smell like. And so I like press the button, and there's a little arc, and I sniff it. Well, that's not great. And you can do the same calculation for what a star would taste like, because the answer is actually much simpler, which is that it would taste sour. Because stars have, the atmosphere it's mostly hydrogen ions. And the sour receptors in your mouth, they bind free hydrogen ions, which you mostly find in acidic solutions, because an acidic solution is one with free hydrogen or a similar ions floating around. And so in a very direct way, like this star is just concentrated sour flavor. And there's that actually answered a mystery for me that I've had from physics for a long time, which was in the report on one of those nuclear accidents where there was a criticality incident in a lab where they had a bomb core and it accidentally went critical because the two halves fell together and people got lethal doses of radiation. And it was this, you know, one of those big cautionary tales, tragic accident. But a detail always stuck out, which was one of them reported, you know, a tingling sensation in their hand that was near the thing and a strong sour taste in their mouth. And that was just tossed out there as a detail. And I had never known what the mechanism was. And then reading these studies and reading about free radicals, you know, if you create a bunch of free radicals, and I checked, you know, talked to a chemist about this who agreed, it's the ionizing radiation ionizing the saliva on your tongue that creates the sour taste. And that's what that person was tasting in the accident. And that's what a star would taste like.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so like that one question that was texted to me.
Just randomly, and that turned into a whole thing.
Yeah, and I spent like the next 6 hours reading about like olfactory bulbs and studies, and then texted back the answer, and then was like, "Do you mind if I use this in my book?"
I got one last question as we head out, and about 50 that I didn't get a chance to ask. With reference to XKCD, did you ever expect, or could you have imagined that people would just refer to them by number in like short conversations? Cause I'll be like with a friend and I'll say something and they'll go XKCD 386. And then, you know, and they just know that that's the number.
Yeah. There are like one or two of them I know by number. It's not that many. And I always feel a little bit like when someone's like, oh, you know, me and my roommate reenacted, you know, comic, and then they'll like list a number. Yeah. And I'm like, oh man, I have a moment where I feel like weirdly like, oh, like I'm a fake fan. I don't really know them by numbers. And I'm like, wait a minute. I wrote that. I am allowed to know however much I know about, you know, and so no, I don't know them all by name. You know, I drew a lot of comics. It's like, I scroll through them and I'm like, when did I do all of this? You know, like this is a lot. So no, I don't know them all by number. I don't know them all by name. Like often I'll go through and I'll find jokes that I forgot I made. And that's always fun because then I get to laugh at them, you know, like, oh yeah, me, you know, 11 years ago in October had a good joke, you know?
Well, this has been now what, like 17 years?
Yeah. Something like that.
Do you have any plan for 20? Are you going to just do this forever, or what is the vibe?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's what I really like about my format is that any day I wake up, I can be like, here's the thing I'm into today. You know, here's what I'm interested in. Here's what I think is funny. And that's what I'm going to do my comic about. When I started off, it was just stick figure doodles for my notebooks. But then it was like, I want to make this cool infographic of this idea I had. I want to make a chart. And then I put that up and people were like, oh, that's what today's comic is. And I'm like, I can do anything I want. You know, like if I think it's interesting and cool and that people would like to look at it, you know, it's a really flexible format. I feel bad for the people who like have a comic where every day, or, you know, a daily thing where they're advancing a story where they have to, they know where the story is going to be tomorrow, you know, and they have to like work within those confines. And there, the temptation to just like reboot it or move it on or change it to something else, like, feels a lot more pressing. But I feel like I've managed to make it so flexible that it's just, you know, whatever I'm into, I can figure out a way to put it in.
That's awesome. Well, I'm glad that you're still having fun.
Yeah. It's you know, hard to imagine a better job. I don't know. I really lucked into something cool, and I'm really just excited to be able to meet people who like are interested in this stuff too. And, you know, think these things are interesting and cool and weird and like this stuff. Cause that makes me more excited about it.
That's awesome. Well, your joy and your fun comes out in the book. The book is What If 2. I would encourage you to check it out. It has honestly allowed my 14 and 16 year olds to do well in honors physics. And they both were like, you're going to meet him in person. They are, you know, like, the idea that this little kid who's not interested in math is interested in math now because there's a T-Rex on a plane is a pretty cool thing. So thank you for,
I'm glad to hear that. I hope they get a lot of fun out of it.
All right. So we've been hanging out with Randall Monroe. The book is What If 2, and this has been Outside In. We'll see you again next time.